Hello and welcome to KUAR's Week in Review podcast. Coming up on the program covering the first week of April 2017.
A federal judge temporarily blocks the execution of one man who's among the eight to die over a 10-day timetable this month. What does the state clemency process have to do with it?
While a federal circuit court says Ohio cannot use a controversial lethal injection drug, we explore issues surrounding midazolam, part of Arkansas's three-drug cocktail.
What's the Arkansas congressional delegation response to President Trump ordering airstrikes against Syria's Assad regime?
The 91st General Assembly wraps up, a look at the unresolved issues, online sales and gas taxes, and a look ahead to a special session on Medicaid.
And it's opening week for the Arkansas Travelers, baseball, bridges, and bat boys.
It's all coming up on KUAR's Week in Review podcast. I'm Chris Hickey.
I'm Jacob Kaufman.
I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotichek.
All right, as we record this, we're still about 10 days away from the first of several scheduled executions in the state of Arkansas occurring over a 10-day period this month. In the midst of all this, there have been a flurry of legal challenges to the processes around scheduling these executions. And one of those primary legal challenges that had a hearing in federal court this week was one involving the clemency process or the clemency request process for these inmates scheduled to die. And out of all this, we heard quite a significant piece of news. Federal Judge D. Price Marshall in Federal District Court issued an injunction against the scheduled execution of one of the men set to die. Joining us in the studio is Sarah Weitz-Kotichek of Arkansas Public Media. How's it going, Sarah?
Great.
Great. You were at the federal courtroom for the entirety of these hearings on the state's clemency process or clemency request process for these inmates. First of all, let's start with the big news, this injunction on this one scheduled execution. Who is this inmate and why was the injunction issued by Federal Judge Marshall?
Jason McGeehee so far is the only one of the inmates who's been recommended for clemency by the parole board. And the hearings this week revolved around a number of legal challenges to the clemency process, but one of the successful ones was the inmate's attorney's argument that a 30-day window required by law after a clemency is recommended, that's for public comment within 30 days, has to be honored. And if the executions proceed in 10 days, that window won't, you know, have been met. So if another inmate, Jack Jones, who's scheduled today to have his clemency hearing is recommended, the judge will extend that injunction to his execution as well.
And the lawyers for the inmates were basically arguing that this compressed schedule for the clemency hearings violated the inmates' right to due process. In the courtroom, who is there testifying about this clemency process and, you know, what was being said? I know that, for instance, the parole board chairman, John Feltz, was called to testify. Director of the Arkansas Department of Correction, Wendy Kelly, was testifying. What were they saying?
Well, John Feltz testified about the parole board's decision to change the policies that are set first in state law and then make their way into the agency regulations about the clemency process. And so, for example, they decided to hold the hearings less than 30 days before the scheduled executions, which was in violation of what was on the books, and then have just an hour for each hearing rather than 2 hours, which is laid out. He actually said that he was not aware of the 30 days following the recommendation that were required after the governor's given that recommendation. So he talked about why he made the decision and that they felt that it was, quote, in the interest of justice, which is a legal justification for changing their rules to see these executions carried out while the state still has a supply of the three drugs. Midazolam is going to expire after April, so he defended his decisions, and then, as you said, Wendy Kelly the next day was testifying, and her testimony was mostly about a claim by the attorneys that she had told her staff not to talk to them. and that that hurt their chances of making a case for clemency about inmates who had, you know, been in the prison system and had relationships with staff. But the judge in the end said that that part of the case really, you know, was not a strong and compelling argument because they had found other ways to allow staff to represent the inmates if they chose to. And one kind of surprising element that arose during the testimony is a woman from an office that works with the parole board to send out notices and deal with some of the paperwork of the clemency process. It turned out that her staff had sent notices to some, but not all of the necessary parties. So they also hadn't sent the entire clemency applications from the men to judges who had been involved in their cases and all of the people who were supposed to get those applications. And so the judge really focused on that. And he said that it just seemed like they were bewildered about how to handle this, and that she had acknowledged that no one in the office had done work on an execution before, and that it was disorganized. And that was one of the most concerning mishaps that happened in this rush to get through the hearings.
And you mentioned they don't have experience. It's been 11 years or so since the state last did an execution. So we know why James McGehee, the judge, ruled the way he did. That's because he has had that clemency request for him. But you kind of mentioned this earlier, that there are arguments made in this suit for people who maybe their clemency requests weren't with merit, but it would still change from 2 hours to one. Where are we on that ruling, on those issues?
You know, the judge deliberated on Thursday and he walked through every aspect of the case and for about an hour. And he explained that he did see both the good and bad and how the process went. He thought that the parole board had been fair because in some instances they had been flexible. They allowed one inmate to submit an application past the deadline and they considered it. Some of the hearings they extended past the hour. The attorneys argued that was arbitrary. That showed an arbitrary process, which was part of their case against how things had gone. But he said that he really struggled over this decision. And in the end, he actually had a really long, like a minute pause before he said that he was denying those injunctions. And the reason is that because the Supreme Court has ruled on a similar case, and particularly Justice O'Connor's ruling set out what the state argued was a bare minimum due process requirement in clemency hearings. And that does not even include the right to a lawyer. So he felt that the state had met that minimal due process requirement, even though they changed the rules and even though there were some clerical errors.
They changed the rule within something that's still legal anyway. Is that
correct? He said all that does not amount to a violation of due process because of that very, very minimal standard. And he explained that clemency is not a right in the same way that there's a right to a trial from the outset, that these men are clearly guilty of horrific crimes. And he said, you know, he acknowledges that the justice system is imperfect, but that clemency is a graciousness that is offered, but is not a right in the same way that other proceedings are. But he did say that he really struggled with that decision because he felt that aspects of it were shoddy. And he seemed like he, you know, he wasn't taking this easily.
And so this injunction issued on McGehee's scheduled execution essentially prevents McGehee from being executed this month because, as you mentioned, one of the three drugs is set to expire. But we should also note that in the case of clemency, the governor, in our case, Governor Asa Hutchinson, is the only person who has the authority to issue clemency for a death row inmate. And so far, he's not issued a clemency that we know of so far.
Right. And it's also important to keep in mind that this is a preliminary injunction to allow a case to proceed. Mm-hmm. So it's decided on the judge's assessment of whether a case has enough merit to go forward at all. So if that gives you a sense of the time that's going to be involved in trying this issue, I would guess it would be more than 10 days or 2 weeks.
Any idea of when this case might keep going?
There are no scheduled dates in this case, but there is another case in federal court next week, which is more broadly challenging the speed and number of executions within the 10-day period. And there was yet another case this week that's might be of particular interest to journalists because it was about what type of information about these drugs can the public and the media have access to, given that the state Supreme Court ruled for the secrecy law? Specifically, there was a Freedom of Information Act appeal to force the state to release the packaging inserts from the execution drugs, which are what was used last year by the Associated Press to identify the manufacturers by comparing packaging. So under the secrecy law that the Supreme Court confirmed after that, receipts, invoices, packaging, all of that is no longer available. So Judge Wendell Griffin, Pulaski Circuit Court, ruled that the state should release information, and then the correction director refused. And in the meantime, the state Supreme Court issued a stay on Wendell Griffin's ruling.
Well, we'll continue to follow the legal developments surrounding these scheduled executions. And thank you, Sarah. Meanwhile, one of these three drugs that's part of the lethal injection protocol planned to be used by the state of Arkansas has garnered quite a bit of controversy, for lack of a better word, in several other states where it's been used. Oklahoma, Ohio, Arizona have all experienced some problems with their lethal injection executions. And in fact, a federal circuit court said this week that the state of Ohio cannot use one of these drugs, midazolam, the sedative, that's been involved in some botched executions around the country. Jacob, could you set up an interview that our content development director, Karen Trico-Stewart, conducted with an Associated Press reporter from Oklahoma talking about this drug, midazolam?
Yeah, so you mentioned that this has been used in a number of other states. This reporter, Sean Murphy, is an Associated Press reporter. He witnessed a botched execution in 2014. Is a went to the U.S. Supreme Court in the end. Clayton Lockett, they used midazolam. And so he spoke with Karen a little bit about his understanding of this drug and why it's so controversial.
Two of the issues we seem to be hearing about in Arkansas, and I think other states are also having this problem. One is just that here in Arkansas, actually unique to Arkansas, is that it's somewhat of an unprecedented timetable in terms of how many people we are executing in 10 days, so 8 people in 10 days. And the other thing we're hearing is just a debate about midazolam and the availability of execution drugs. And so I was wondering if we could start with midazolam, and you could tell me, before we dive into, you know, anything more in depth, can you tell me the basics of what midazolam is and why it's become somewhat controversial here in the U.S.?
Sure. Well, midazolam is a sedative that's used typically for minor procedures. It is commonly referred to by one of its brand names of Versed, and its use in executions has been somewhat problematic. There have been a number of cases in which midazolam has been used and executions have gone wrong in some ways. There was obviously a notable execution in Arizona where the inmate gasped for air for long periods of time and they had to continue to use multiple doses of the drug. And then there was also an execution in Ohio that was problematic for the same reason. I've witnessed two executions that involved the use of midazolam. The first was in 2014 with Clayton Lockett, and then it was used again in 2015 for the execution of Charles Warner. And obviously, I'm not a pharmacologist, but I have heard testimony from pharmacologists, and some of that testimony indicated that midazolam is not an ideal drug to use in executions, just for a number of reasons. And I think that's clear because for years, Oklahoma and other states used other fast-acting barbiturates like sodium thiopental and pentobarbital that were seemingly much more effective. But as you indicated, those drugs have become harder to get as the manufacturers prohibited their use in executions. And as a result, states, and certainly this is the case in Oklahoma had used sodium thiopental and pentobarbital and other fast-acting barbiturates for years in executions and ultimately could not obtain those drugs, and that is why they settled on midazolam.
So I think that's pretty thorough about some of the problems with that and other states have experienced. Let me just read something, if you will, Chris, as our gracious host of the podcast this afternoon.
Certainly.
If you'll allow me the privilege.
You are allowed.
Thank you, Delegate. So Kenneth Williams, who is one of the death row inmates who is scheduled to die, I believe, on April 20th, his clemency, all of his things are exhausted, basically. So he wrote an article for the Marshall Project and Vice. And here's one segment of it. It's a really great article. Everyone should look for it. It's called My Execution 20 Days Away. And so he's basically talking about what it's like to know you're going to die in 20 days. Here's one section about this specific thing. I know that midazolam, one of the drugs used in the cocktail to put prisoners to death, doesn't always anesthetize the prisoner completely. Since I'm one of the last to be executed, there are some people who think that if one of the first executions is botched, it could prolong the lives of the others, including me. But I don't want to live only because someone else suffers that agony. Others suffering in order that I live for however much longer, that's no hope at all, not if I truly have learned my lesson to value other people's lives. So, clearly, this is something the prisoners on death row are thinking about, that this drug might not work like it's supposed to.
Yep, but as we know, the state of Arkansas still has no plans to use any other drugs.
Right, and the U.S. Supreme Court, they looked at the Clayton Lockett case and others, and this drug is legal to use in the United States.
Except for in Ohio, as we mentioned. But the,
we'll see, the circuit court is not the court of the land.
Yes, Arkansas is covered by the 8th Circuit Court of Appeals rather than, I think it was the 12th that ruled in the Ohio case.
So I'm going to go with 6th, but I'm not sure.
Oh, well, a different circuit court.
Yeah.
The discussion around executions obviously revolves around these pharmaceuticals that are at issue. And on the world stage, we have another set of not pharmaceuticals, but chemicals being used in warfare illegally under international treaties and agreements by Syria's Assad regime. Now, these reports that came out this week of a chemical attack in the, I think it was the Idlib province of Syria, killed somewhere around 70 people, injured hundreds more in this area of Syria, are still being confirmed, but the Trump administration took swift, decisive action this week in sending missile strikes to Syrian air bases in retaliation. Now, Jacob, you've been kind of following Arkansas's congressional delegation and their views on this episode and the years-long conflict of Syria and America's involvement or lack of involvement in that war. What are they saying?
Well, the state's all-Republican congressional delegation is basically, those of whom have chimed in so far as we record this on Friday afternoon, have all praised the attack, you know, saying it was a swift, appropriate, proportional response was a lot of the language used. But, you know, it struck me that while everyone praised the decision as a swift, proportionate response, it seems everyone's a little hesitant to go too far down the rabbit hole with Syria, at least with the state's Republican delegation. Here's a quote from Senator John Bozeman's statement. Moving forward, the administration must engage with Congress to seek approval for further action. He also wanted a more detailed strategic plan laid out that has some type of end goal in mind. So, I mean, that's kind of always the issue with what's going on in Syria. In a way, Obama's administration was sort of doing that, you know, supporting all sorts of forces that are at war with Assad. So small, like limited engagement seems to be like something everybody seems is pretty palatable on this. We don't really know what Donald Trump's position on this is. He was someone who routinely said that we should not have engage in Syria. He's, of course, notably friendly with Russia on all sorts of things. Russia is a clear back of the Assad regime. Russia has launched airstrikes in support of Bashar al-Assad. And in response to this, Russia said they're going to help Syria's anti-air apparatus. So what does that mean exactly? Next time we send missiles in, we're going to be fighting Russian warplanes, possibly? I mean, so I think everyone does not want to get too entangled on this. We certainly don't see anyone in the congressional delegation calling for massive boots on the ground at this point.
All right, thanks. And I should note that if you're a listener who's interested in this episode and this situation in Syria and America's involvement and Russia's involvement on the side of the Assad regime, you might want to take note. There's going to be an interesting talk coming up on Monday, April 10th at 6 p.m. at the Dara Center Auditorium at the Main Library in Little Rock. A expert on Russia and U.S.-Russian relationships, strategic interests, and the world order, at least that's how the talk is billed, is going to be speaking. And it'll be certainly a timely discussion given the investigations into possible Trump campaign and Russian collusion during the electoral campaign, as well as Russian influence in trying to sway that campaign. It's Dr. Cheryl Cross, director of the Kosmetsky Center at St. Edward's University in Austin. She's got a pretty interesting resume in political science and also had studied military affairs, as well as she was a Fulbright scholar in Moscow for a while. And she also worked as a consultant for the RAND Corporation. So very much an expert on geopolitics. That talk's coming up on Monday.
I just want to add refugees, of course, as we talk about Syria all the time about the refugee issue. Donald Trump said it wasn't just the chemical weapons being used, but that he saw that, I think his words were like babies, little bitty babies were attacked. And so people on the left, of course, note that he might have a lot of compassion, at least in this instance, for the children of the war. He does not necessarily want to take any of them in as refugees. So that issue, of course, is at the center of all this.
In what would any other week probably be the top news in the state,
yeah,
the 91st General Assembly.
Let's get excited. Legislature talk.
Has drawn to a close, or a near close, not an official close. It'll still be almost another month before they completely adjourn and sine die, as they say, or sine die, or whatever that
means.
We're
going to learn how to pronounce it whenever they do it. It's going to be pretty exciting.
Yeah, but they did recess, as you mentioned, this week, and Monday was the day for last gasps for some legislation that had failed to pass in previous attempts. Jacob, let's talk about the online sales tax bill. What happened?
Sure. You know, and the two things we're going to talk about today briefly were both carried by Dan Douglas, a Republican out of Bentonville. And they were pretty big ticket items that they weren't explicitly on the governor's agenda, though he seemed to mostly back both of them. First one was the idea of collecting an online sales tax from retailers who do not have a physical presence in Arkansas. Amazon is the big one we talk about. Amazon began voluntarily collecting this tax on March 1st, interestingly enough. But here's an argument from Representative Dan Douglas. He is a very colorful commentator.
I wear Wrangler blue jeans, all right? Why? Because they're cheap. I'm buying for $19.95 a pair. And they make my booty look better, or so I'm told. But the thing is, I buy five pair a year because I get them stained up and torn up on the farm. And I went to buy my annual five pair of Wrangler blue jeans, and I went to Academy Sporting Goods. They always have a good choice, but they only had one pair in my size. So I bought it, and I paid sales tax. I then went to my favorite place to shop, Tractor Supply Company. And I found one more pair in my size, and I purchased them, and I paid sales tax there. And then I thought, you know, I'm tired of running around here looking for things. I'm going to go home and order them over the internet. And I went home, and I ordered three more pair over the internet, and they did not collect and remit sales tax. They're the same brand of blue jeans, the same style, the same size, used on the same fat body, for the same purpose, and they didn't collect sales tax. Now, is that fair? And part of our jobs is to be fair and equitable. You know, as far as the fairness, I want to use one more example, and then I'm going to shut up. Y'all have heard enough of me this session, but as far as fairness goes, you don't have to smile that big, Representative Ballinger.
Anyway, this online sales tax, no one really knows how much money it would generate, but somewhere between $50 and $200 million seems to be the estimates. DFNA was kind of hesitant to give an exact number on that. It's never been collected before. And in theory, this tax is already supposed to be collected, but it's up to individual customers, you and I, to notice we didn't get it charged a sales tax and have to figure it out on our taxes each year. Opposition came from Republicans who don't want an additional tax. Bob Ballinger, who's mentioned at the end of that quote, later got up and made a speech and said, even if it is already the law of the land, I'm not going back to my district telling people they got to start paying a new sales tax. And then there are Democrats who wanted their money specifically dedicated to certain projects like pre-K, rural emergency services, perhaps highways instead of a gas tax plan that also never got anywhere by Dan Douglas. I didn't play anyone in opposition just because their speeches weren't as colorful, and we've talked about this for weeks and weeks. So here's Representative Charlie Collins out of Fayetteville. He loves doing food metaphors, actually.
The last thing I want to touch on is this question about the pieces of the pie. I'm telling you, I'm promising you, we're going to use at least this much money to reduce income taxes. But it doesn't really matter much how the pieces are divided if we do not have the courage to bake the pie.
So close vote each time. It took like four times to get out of committee. It was very strange. These people are clearly very frustrated. Charlie Collins, Dan Douglas, these are like top-ranking mainstream Republicans that usually get things passed, too. But anyway, I think this is something that will eventually happen. We see Amazon doing it voluntarily. Just maybe, you know, it might take a special session or 2 or 5 years or something, but it seems inevitable. Almost every state does this. And it's neat in Arkansas because we, unlike other states, don't have as many businesses here with physical presences for whatever reason.
And you mentioned that, you know, since Amazon is starting to collect this tax and DFNA does not have an estimate yet as to how much that will mean in terms of revenue for the state. DFNA says that Amazon is supposed to be remitting that tax, or they should start getting collections after the end of April. And I should also mention that there's a revenue report came out this week. Again, lower than expected state revenue by about $50 million, although this time it was corporate income tax collections that were to blame. Some detail about the filing dates being kind of off target. But, you know, we also saw sales and use taxes down and individual income tax collections were down again. This is most months out of this fiscal year have right. been below projections in terms of revenue collections.
The thing that's always most ominous to me about that is when the revenue is coming in below projections at a time when the state is having record low unemployment. So imagine if we had unemployment that was growing or just what it was 6 years ago, then the revenue for the state would be even worse, plus social services needs would be increased because people would be out of work.
Yeah, so it's certainly an issue for the economists to untangle.
Yeah, not you or I.
Yeah. Meanwhile,
some vetoes happened.
Yeah. So the governor had a press conference earlier this week where on the wrap of the special session, and he showed for the reporters there this big stack of papers, which were all the bills that had landed on his desk that he had to either sign or review or veto. And in fact, he did veto one this week, Jacob.
A couple, in fact, it turns out.
Yeah.
All right. So here's the big one that he vetoed, though. So it seems before Donald Trump was president, we talked about Black Lives Matter for like a year or two. And now we don't talk about it that much, you know, after Donald Trump's election. So there's a number of bills across the country, some in Arkansas, that seemed designed at targeting these protests. One was by Trent Garner out of El Dorado, a Republican senator that has worked with Tom Cotton's campaign. It banned so-called mass picketing. That, you know, we've heard about picketing, we've heard about demonstrations, people blocking streets and the like. So the governor vetoed it. Let me find where I put the copy of his veto letter. Important to note, in Arkansas, overriding a veto only takes a simple majority, so no additional votes. It's kind of like symbolic. does someone in their party want to go against the governor when they come back? Then they have to stay in session a couple more days to override the veto. It's kind of a little bit of pressure on you. So I write to inform you that today I have vetoed Senate Bill 550. I've done so because the bill in its current form is overbroad, vague, and will have the effect of restricting both free speech and the right to assemble. So governor's got some concerns that this is a little too broad. He notes that there's already laws against disruptive conduct and obstructing governmental operations and the like.
Yeah, and it's interesting that, you know, Senator Garner was, of course, one of the co-sponsors of this big expansion of concealed carry rights in the state, basically arguing that the Second Amendment and the right to carry arms is a God-given right enumerated in the Constitution and the state constitution as well. But this other bill that he sponsored does not seem to hold the same kind of admiration for the First Amendment, which the governor is kind of referring to in terms of right to assemble and speech and so
forth. Right. And here's another, the governor's, you know, he notes that it's important to guarantee the safety of people. He said, however, this bill fails to identify bright line differentiation between constitutionally protected activity and activity subject to penalties outlined in the bill.
All right. Well, thanks for that update. Well, enough of this government and politics. Yeah. Let's talk about some real issues facing Americans, like springtime and baseball.
Oh, yeah, the national pastime. I've heard of that.
The Arkansas Travelers.
Yeah, they're having their home opener for the probably 189th million year in a row. Okay, Arkansas Travelers are one of the most historic minor league teams, professional clubs in all of America, over 100 years of baseball, coming out of the Travelers organization off and on in some form. This year is, I believe, it's between 11th and 13th season at Tickey Stevens Park in North Little Rock. I was a big fan of Ray Winder, which they tore down to my dismay, but Tickey Stevens is also very nice. And this year, one big difference is they'll no longer be with the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim. They still have all those things in their name. Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim.
Yeah, yeah.
And now they'll be with another West Coast American League team, the Seattle Mariners. For my entire life, pretty much, they were a Cardinals affiliate, which made, like, regional sense. We've jumped that boat now several seasons ago.
And I went to the opening game on Thursday night. They lost a heartbreaking loss to the Corpus Christi Hooks 2-1. It was a pitcher's duel for much of the game. For, I think, about the first five innings, the starter for the Travelers, whoever it was throwing a no-hitter. But then the closer, whoever that was.
It's a good minor league roundup.
Obviously, I was.
Get any hot dogs? Any brews?
No, I had some peanuts. I did have some brews, that which may be,
why can't we,
maybe why.
Did you get a locally made beer or a
I did.
A
tall boy. I got a Diamond Bear Pale Ale.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So, anyways, let's get to
our
the
own
news.
Intrepid David Wallace went out to the field before the game.
Yes, David Wallace, who is a sports guru,
he's an announcer too for high school football championship games.
Yeah, you can hear him on Saturday mornings here on KUAR, broadcasting our news. But you know, he occasionally goes out and covers things for us, like this.
No sound ushers in springtime more optimistically. The Class AA Travelers of the Texas League unveiled their 2017 version in an open workout last night. Ken Bear wouldn't have missed it. As a kid, he shagged balls during batting practice back at Ray Winder Field in the 60s.
Shagged balls out there in left field. And I got all kinds of stories about out there over the years.
Bear says he's been a season ticket holder for more than 25 years.
People get to be like family out here because they know each other, come year after year. The people sitting around down here where I sit, we came from the old ballpark.
A whole new team.
Shirley Reeve was also there, as she's been for more than 50 years. For the first time in 16 years, she was not watching a farm team of the Los Angeles Angels.
Well, we went with a new organization, so that means all new players.
The Travs switched their affiliation in the offseason to the Seattle Mariners, following the path of former Angels general manager Jerry DiPaolo, who is now with the Mariners. Seattle's AA team moves from Jackson, Tennessee to North Little Rock.
We just didn't have that same connection that we had had with Jerry DiPaolo, Scott Service, Mike McCucci, Tim Bogar, Mike Hampton, all those guys who ended up coincidentally in Seattle.
Paul Allen enters his fifth season as Travelers GM.
We believe in what they do. They want their players to grow together, win together as a team, and kind of move together up in through the ranks. They believe in winning. If they can win at the lower levels, they kind of grow up and win together.
So, for one of the rare times in their history, the entire Travs roster is new, as is the coaching staff and manager Darren Brown.
Try to develop players in a winning atmosphere. So, going out and trying to win ball games is something that they're going to hear. The fact of it is, when they get to the big leagues, we need them to know how to win.
This manager, I saw his dad play at Ray Winder Field.
Brown's father, Paul, pitched for the Travs from 1963 through 65 before Darren Brown was born. Middle infielder Adam Law could be one of the team's best hitters.
We're just ecstatic to be here. Great ballpark, great atmosphere, and we're itching to go.
Law has played at Dickey Stevens with Tulsa before getting traded to the Mariners and playing the last half of last year in Jackson.
Let's just say this is a step up from Jackson. In ballpark, in fan support, in the amenities in the clubhouse, the eating room, the lounge areas that we have, we're so fortunate to be here.
A three-game set with Corpus Christi lifts the curtain, with tonight's opener starting at 7:10. David Wallace, KUAR News.
Hey, how about that? Sports reporting from Public Radio.
Yeah, that's right. And also, another detail, if you go to the Travelers game, you'll see the brand new Broadway Bridge in the background,
yes,
in the outfield, which was dedicated this week to veterans of all wars on the 100th anniversary of America's involvement in World War I.
In case we have any listeners up there from Northwest Arkansas, I'm going to read you an excerpt of a planning email that our own Chris Hickey wrote. Since you mentioned the Broadway Bridge, the dedication will coincide with the opening game of the Arkansas Travelers baseball team, who are, by default, infinitely and exponentially more talented and accomplished than the Northwest Arkansas Naturals. So that's our opinion here at KUAR Public Radio. We were pretty adamant about that.
Yeah, and oh yeah, and what's the deal with the Bat Boys at the Travelers?
Oh yeah, so I've been talking about this for way too long, but 1 year I had a friend that graduated from Hendricks College. Fine school, you know, and then I saw him on the field,
sure.
You know, he's like 6'5", and I saw him on the Arkansas Travelers field in uniform, and he was a bat boy, but he's not a boy at all. He's a bat man. he's taller than some of the players.
Yeah, yeah.
So anyway, I talked to the Travelers spokesman guy, the guy on the field, Lance, who goes, "Eat more chicken, eat more chicken," during the Chick-fil-A promotional things between innings. And I've also seen him give a speech at the Butler Center. He's really smart, seems like a really good guy. So anyway, he said that, and I'm trying to figure out if this is minor league baseball wide. I think it's only in the Texas League, that basically the Bat Boys weren't doing a good enough job. They were goofing off too much, horsing around. So a bunch of the managers decided it's time to bring some men into that role. So now you got to be 18 and older if you want to be a bat boy in the Texas League to pick up the bats and balls.
All right. With that, thanks for listening to KUAR's Week in Review podcast. KUAR is a listener-supported service of the University of Arkansas at Little Rock in partnership with UAMS, although we are editorially independent. It's Fun Drive Week coming up. Be sure to pledge your support. Go to KUAR.org or call 569-8485 or 1-800-952-2528.
And let us know if you're pledging specifically because of the podcast.
Yeah.
It'll give us a reason to keep going on.
Yeah, and send us your comments at comments@KUAR.org. We're trying to rebrand the podcast eventually to have a snazzy name. So if you have a snazzy name in mind, we can use that. Anyways, I am Chris Hickey, and you are
Jacob Kaufman.
And
this
again.
Is
this is the KUAR Week in Review podcast. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Bye.